You can make a case on this day before Thanksgiving that really the thing to be thankful for is this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday today, the 27th of November. Good as always to have you along, everybody. The day before a federal holiday, it may be, but the gears of the economic data system never do rest. We've got a raft of reports to tell you about that came out this morning, most of which were, all things considered, public radio inside joke intended, by the way, pretty good. Orders for durable goods, big, heavy stuff that's supposed to last more than 3 years, they were up. A decline had been expected. First-time claims for unemployment benefits were down. That's a good thing. And an early look at third-quarter gross domestic product was revised up to 2.1%. Not the 3% the Trump administration has been promising, but good. So we are going to spend a couple of minutes at the top of the program on a slice of that GDP data, something called business investment. A key, although lacking of late part, of what makes this economy go. Marketplace's Justin Ho starts us off.
Business investment has been shrinking for the last two quarters. But last quarter, the decline wasn't as steep as expected. Sarah Watthouse is an economist at Wells Fargo Securities.
We're not seeing it fall off a cliff by any means. Companies are still spending, but they've certainly illustrated some hesitancy in recent months.
House says the trade war is making companies less willing to spend on expensive new factories, which take years to complete. Today, John Deere reported that the trade war has made farmers cautious about making major investments in new equipment. Instead, House says businesses are spending more on intangible items, which aren't as vulnerable to economic cycles.
So things like software, research and development to help companies come up with that next big product or idea. So that's accounting for an increasing share of business investment.
Companies did spend more on certain tangible items. Overall spending on equipment fell, but within that, spending on industrial equipment went up. So did spending on the buildings that house that equipment. George Perks is global macro strategist for Bespoke Investment Group.
Those are both much firmer than you would expect based on manufacturing industry surveys, so that's a relatively hopeful sign.
Still, businesses spent less on new commercial buildings, less on transportation equipment, less on new hospitals. It's a trend that reflects a broader shift in the U.S. economy, says Alex Crescino at Manulife Investment Management.
Manufacturing has become increasingly less important as a percentage of GDP, and the services sector, which is supported by software, has become increasingly important.
While today's GDP data found that business investment is shrinking, the same report said spending on services is growing. In New York, I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We have talked before on the show quite a bit, actually, about the Trump administration and the global technology industry and the White House trying to isolate that slice of the American economy from the rest of the world. The latest, some new powers given to the Secretary of Commerce to block purchases of foreign information technology or communications technology deemed threatening to the United States. Marketplace's Scott Song reports.
The new powers are meant to counter what the Trump administration calls the unusual and extraordinary threat that foreign-made technology can pose. For instance, a cyber attack 3 years ago used web-connected digital cameras and DVR machines made in China to take down much of the American internet. Elsa Kania is with the Center for New American Security.
Devices that are connected to the internet, which are often poorly secured, have proven very disruptive. We're already seeing the weaponization of these devices occurring.
The new rules, which are not final yet, will let the Secretary of Commerce scuttle business deals that pose undue risks. This covers a huge range of sectors. Smartphones, computers, TVs, cloud storage, internet service, says attorney Claire Reed at Arnold & Porter. And it threatens all kinds of everyday business.
The buying, importing something, transferring it, dealing in it, or using it. From a business perspective, it's terrifying.
The Commerce Secretary will decide whether to target tech deals. Cliff Kupchin, chairman of the Eurasia Group Consultancy, says that discretion makes things unpredictable to Silicon Valley and vulnerable to the politics of the moment.
If we get two very protectionist candidates like Warren or Sanders and Trump, this issue, how hard to cramp down on imports of Chinese technology, it's ripe for the pickings in the campaign.
and to him, ripe for the unwinding of a global, innovative, high-tech supply chain. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
It was a full session on Wall Street today. Tomorrow is off, obviously, then a short day Friday, so traders were in a buying mood. Record highs when we do the numbers. Kind of faded from the headlines here, but a month into the NBA season, its games still aren't being broadcast on China's state-run CCTV. Last month, you might remember the Houston Rockets general manager crossed one of Beijing's red lines, tweeting his support for the protesters in Hong Kong. With the economic clock ticking for the NBA in one of its most lucrative markets, one might imagine league officials are wondering how long this grudge match might last. As Marketplace's Jennifer Pack reports from Shanghai, the NBA would do well to look at South Korean businesses in China.
South Korean pop music is big business in China. Here's the Korean group EXO singing in Mandarin on Chinese state TV. The group was all set to perform in Shanghai in 2016. Then South Korea had signed a deal with the U.S. to deploy an American missile defense system called THAAD on its territory. The concert was abruptly canceled. Oh Gwang-jin is with the South Korean news site Chosun Biz. He was reporting from Beijing for the news outlet at the time.
The Chinese government never issued reasons why Korean pop acts and TV series were suddenly canceled. But we all knew officials weren't happy about THAAD.
The Chinese government believes THAAD is a tool for the U.S. to spy on the Chinese, which meant South Korea had crossed a red line. The public soon joined in the anger against Korean companies. A video widely circulated at the time showed rows of Chinese school children pumping their fists in the air and chanting, "A boycott of South Korean products starts with me."
Many Koreans watched this video and were terrified of such young children calling for a boycott of South Korean firms.
Journalist Oh Gwang-jin. He says the hardest hit company was South Korean retail giant Lotte. Most of its 100-plus supermarkets in China were shut down by local governments.
They said the stores violated fire safety codes and had other legal issues. It was definitely a retaliation.
Retaliation, he says, for Lotte giving land to the South Korean military to build the THAAD missile defense system. The company had no choice, says Sean Ryan, who wrote the book The War for China's Wallet.
This was something that they had to do because they were ordered by the South Korean government.
And when countries and politics collide, he says, companies just need to take the hit.
With South Korea, there was no hope. No matter what the CEO of Lotte said, no matter what the CEOs of Hyundai said, they were going to get slammed because it was a massive geopolitical issue and they were coming from a relatively small country.
Han Jae-jin is with the Hyundai Research Institute in South Korea.
We estimate that South Korea suffered an economic loss of about $7.3 billion in 2017 because of the THAAD crisis. That's the equivalent to 0.5% of South Korea's GDP.
Today, the consumer boycotts have gone away, but Lotte, which was already struggling to be profitable in China, was pushed over the edge by the backlash. Again, journalist Oh Gwang-jin.
Lotte is a Fortune 500 company, and yet its core operations in China just suddenly disappeared.
The company has sold all its supermarkets in China. And other South Korean firms, says Oh Gwang-jin, are thinking twice before doing business here. In Shanghai, I'm Jennifer Pak for Marketplace.
The high-paying jobs in this economy, banking and high-tech consulting too, probably, They demand 60, sometimes 70 or more hour work weeks. Here's the thing, though. Low-wage work, especially when you're juggling a couple of 3-4 jobs, demands that many hours just to make ends meet. So consider that the setup for today's installment of our ongoing series, My Economy.
My name is Louise Eberle. I'm 32 years old, and I live in Columbus, Ohio. When I graduated from college, I moved to New York from the Midwest, and I was interested in being where the arts were. I was a modern dancer, but since that doesn't pay a whole lot, I picked up a bunch of other jobs, all kind of part-time and gig work. I felt like I had very little leverage. You know, I'd have this employer would offer me good wages, but a really, unreliable schedule. There would be occasions that I, you know, had an employer that I was like, look, I like this job. I like this line of work, but I need to know from week to week what I can expect to make so that I can plan my life accordingly. And I felt really prepared. I like coached with a friend to like go in with my pitch to be like, I need to make this much and I need to be able to count on this amount of work. And my boss was kind of just like, yeah, good luck with that. This is what it is, and you're welcome to walk. When I was 29, I moved back to Columbus, Ohio, which is where I grew up. So I went back and did a number of like education classes and student taught. And this is my first year as a full-time public school teacher. I love being around young people, but a big part of the appeal of teaching was that it's a union job and it's just super clear what the salary scale is this year. And I know what the salary scale is for the following year. The idea of being able to know that I'll have enough and to be able to predict and plan and have some sort of stability is like far more enticing than the idea of accumulating, you know, a large amount of wealth. I have, you know, a 40-hour week contract, and something that's really nice about that is I am able to leave at the end of the day and have my evening ahead of me to do the things that make me feel well, whether it's go to a yoga class, work in my garden, make healthy dinners with my partner. I don't feel that I have to prove my dedication by staying late at night. I don't feel like I look uncompetitive compared to my coworkers if I'm not working 50 or 60-hour weeks.
Louise Eberle, she is in Columbus, Ohio. Let us know what's happening in your economy, would you? You can do that at marketplace.org. Coming up.
People want that. It's the number two most valued commodity in the waste stream today.
Trash, but also cash. First, though, let's do the numbers. As I said, all three of the major indices hit record highs today. The Dow Industrial's up 42 points, a tenth percent, 28,164. The NASDAQ gained 57 points, about six-tenths percent, 8,705. The S&P 500 added 13 points, four-tenths percent, 31.53 there. Worries about the trade war at Deere & Company that Justin was mentioning earlier dragged shares in the construction equipment maker down 4.2%. Competitors took hits too. Caterpillar off 0.2%. AGCO, AGCO Corporation, lost 1.9%. Let's check in on the turkey index here, shall we? Seaboard Corporation, which owns the Butterball brand, picked up 0.7%. Hormel Foods, which owns the Jenny O turkey brand, as well as, by the way, Spam, gained 1.3%. I don't know why I know that. You're listening to Marketplace.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts, Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. About 60 miles, give or take, south of Silicon Valley is one of the world's most productive agricultural areas. The Salinas Valley, sometimes in fact called the salad bowl of the world, grows billions of dollars of lettuce and other crops. But as high tech and the rest of the economy grows, farm workers in the region face rising rents, stagnant wages, and homelessness in alarming proportions. Brian Goldstone is a writer and an anthropologist as well. He profiled one family's experience with homelessness for California Sunday Magazine. Brian, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So the details of this story, the family you profile, I mean, those details are wrenching, right, and horrible. But it's the big picture here that's the story, right, the manifest and rampant homelessness.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I was drawn to this particular family is because they are so representative of what has become an epidemic of homelessness in the United States, and that is an inability to remain housed despite, in their case, you know, working two full-time jobs.
Right, which gets to the through line of this story, and you say it up top. It's a crisis not of poverty, but of prosperity. Explain that a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, unlike other widespread crises of homelessness in the U.S. Since really, you know, going back to the beginning of this country, which have emerged more in times of economic downturns, the most recent being the foreclosure crisis and, you know, the Great Recession of 2007-2008. What's different about what we're seeing now is that this is happening at a time of economic boom and prosperity. And I see families like the one I wrote about in this story as casualties, you know, not of a failing economy, but a booming one.
Give me the lay of the land, because that's really relevant here. The Salinas Valley is an agricultural region in Northern California in proximity to Silicon Valley, which makes it all the more increases the tension, I guess, as it were.
That's right. I mean, so the attention that places like Silicon Valley and the Bay Area and cities like LA have been getting in the media with these, you know, vast encampments, homeless encampments on the streets, that situation has begun to kind of reverberate into surrounding areas. So the idea that you could simply, you know, leave those cities and go to a cheaper area nearby is really no longer the case. Apartment owners are getting rid of low-income housing units and putting more expensive condos and apartments in their place. So that's really just created widespread instability for those agricultural workers.
I don't want to spoil the article, but my guess is most people hearing this won't have a chance to read it. It does end somewhat happily. The family gets rent assistance and does wind up renting a house. But as I said in the introduction, you've got a background in anthropology. Give me your anthropological take on what this does to a family.
With this particular family, you just see the cascading effects of this homelessness as time goes on. That's where it really becomes important, I think, to situate our reporting in a longer period of time, because you can see how a family just and individuals just begin to kind of deteriorate under these conditions. And that obviously makes the prospects for getting out of this hole, as the father in this family referred to it, increasingly difficult.
Brian Goldstone, he's a writer and anthropologist. He's got a piece in California Sunday Magazine about homelessness in the Salinas Valley in Northern California. Brian, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time. Great story.
Thanks for having me.
Strong corporate brands can be good, right? If companies do it well, there's lots of consumer affinity, there's lots of profit upside, everybody's happy. Brands, though, can also be a burden. If there's a crisis or there's bad press or almost anything negative, brand awareness is a double-edged sword. Exhibit A for us today, plastic waste. From the Allegheny Front, Julie Grant has the story.
Penn State chemistry professor Sherry Mason researches plastic, which means she spends a lot of time collecting trash near an industrial area at Mill Creek in Erie, Pennsylvania.
What you'll notice is that vast majority of it is either styrofoam or bottles. It's a lot of plastic bottles.
Mason comes here a few times a week with a large rake and pulls up litter. Later at the lab, her students will categorize it by product, material, and type of container. As Mason talks, more trash blows in.
I can't see the brand on that one. I'm very interested in the brands.
She's interested because she wants to know the source of the trash to provide data about what's in the waters, bags, cigarette butts, bottles, for cities considering plastic bans, and also to trace it back to the companies that make those products. Companies like Coca-Cola. Volunteers for the Break Free from Plastic organization, a nonprofit, collect plastic trash once a year across the globe. Coke topped its list in 2018 and 2019, followed by Nestle and PepsiCo.
I'm not surprised that that would be the finding.
Bruce Karras is Coke's vice president of sustainability in North America. He says Coca-Cola packaging shows up so often because the company has such a big share of the bottled beverage market. He also says Coke wants to collect more plastic bottles to reduce trash and because the material is valuable. It can be manufactured into other products.
We compete heavily with the fiber industry, with the carpeting industry. People want that. It's the number two most valued commodity in the waste stream today behind aluminum.
He says the average Coke bottle is made with 10% recycled plastic. The company's goal is 50% by 2030. Pepsi's goal is to use 25% recycled plastic by 2025. But recycled plastic is more expensive than the new stuff.
Ideally, you would think that a recycled material should be cheaper. And today it's not.
One reason? Cheap natural gas is fueling an increase in new plastic production. Also, China has stopped taking plastic waste from the U.S., reducing the market for U.S. recyclables, so many recycling programs around the country are collapsing. In October, Coke, Pepsi, and Keurig Dr. Pepper, maker of plastic coffee pods, announced a $100 million joint effort to improve plastic recycling programs in different parts of the country.
The game is really, can I get efficient enough to bring those costs in line so it's at least parity pricing or better?
Dwayne Stanford, editor of Beverage Digest, a trade journal, says consumers and shareholders are looking to companies to find real solutions to plastic pollution, not just token efforts.
We're at the stage where companies, because it's so important to how consumers react to their products and therefore so important to their bottom line, that they have to make it a fundamental part of how they do business.
At Mill Creek, Sherry Mason sees bottle labels that ask consumers to please recycle. But she says the burden for reducing plastic waste needs to be on the companies.
You make the product. It's up to you to make sure that it gets properly taken care of.
Mason says people buy these brands because they want the product inside, not the plastic container. In Erie, Pennsylvania, I'm Julie Grant for Marketplace.
Today is one of the busier travel days of the year. Millions, tens of millions of people are out there on the roads or in the skies on the way to see friends and family for the holiday. The place they're not? In the office, which is good, because even though holiday travel can be stressful, there is actual scientific evidence that shows taking time off is better for your health. That's the setup for the latest in our series highlighting some of the more creative ways that people say, "Hey, I'm out of the office." We call it automatic reply.
Hi there, I'm out of the office on vacation. Since multitasking isn't a thing, link to Cleveland Clinic article, and vacation is incredibly important for the health of a person and a company, link to Harvard Business Review, I'm spending the time focusing on relaxing, reflecting, and not looking at screens. By the time you're reading this, my computer has been thrown into the ocean. Metaphorically. I'll get back to you upon my return.
That's Emily Thies in Boston, Massachusetts. Tell us, would you, about an out-of-office message you have seen or heard? You can do that at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, just because it's been in the news so much. Apple Maps has gotten itself caught up in the Ukrainian war with Russia. Remember 5 years ago, right? Russia illegally annexed Crimea. There was much international condemnation, a wider war in eastern Ukraine, eventually the whole political thing here that you've been hearing about. And now, Apple Maps. The BBC reports that Apple has agreed to demands from the Russian government that when pulled up inside Russia, Crimea is officially shown as Russian territory. Okay, we're going. The Dow up 42 today, a tenth percent. The NASDAQ gained 57.6 tenths percent. S&P 500 added 13 points, 4 tenths percent, record highs all the way around. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Robin Edgar, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Jay Siebold, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APN.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.